It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. Today's talk is on generosity, the first of the six heroic practices of bodhisattvas. The perfections of the bodhisattva do not support me. It is I who support them, says Shantideva, the great 7th century Buddhist poet. And while Shakyamuni Buddha was endowed with great compassion and wisdom, he too constantly supported the six paramitas, in particular, dana, the first one that really is the basis for the other five. Last week, after we stopped, someone submitted a question. If the paramitas are a state of mind, then should we try to cultivate the state of mind over and above looking for actual ways to be generous, for example? And the answer is yes, always. Always start with your heart. Always start with your heart. Cultivating a generous heart will create continual responses from the world. When your heart and mind is open, its opportunities for generosity will just arise. And don't forget, the title of this series is the subtitle to Reb's book, Entering the Mind of Buddha. So generosity is not something that the Buddha has. It's something the Buddha is. The Buddha is generosity. That's the substance of Buddha, the mind of Buddha. It's not only something that he does. It's who he is. And the Buddha practices the six perfections so that we will learn to practice the six perfections. The Buddha at all times is a teacher. He doesn't forget that at all times he's a teacher. So when he practices the six perfections, it's so that we will learn to practice the six perfections. And if our practice is sincere, we too will become a Buddha. Generosity attends and responds with kindness to whatever turns up, including people and events we find challenging. Remember the story of where the young man about to go off on a long journey asks a wise woman for parting words of advice. And she says, no matter what happens, I always try to say, thank you very much. I have no complaints whatsoever. We've talked about this before. And so she gives him this practice. And then he comes back years later, apologizing for not being able to do it. And she says, thank you very much. I have no complaints whatsoever. And Reb says that this is a story about wholehearted generosity, because there is nothing toward which she doesn't give her wholehearted acceptance. So in Buddhism, there are three kinds Buddhism loves numbers. So there are three kinds of gifts: material things, fearlessness, and dharma. Regarding the first, material things, Tenchin Roshi teaches that in the training of generosity, we focus on offering our life and practice as a gift, which includes allowing people and ourselves to be authentic and to not be attached to our own thoughts and feelings. So those two things, authenticity and not being attached to our own thoughts and feelings, are how we practice giving our life as a gift. And both are really hard. But if you have a hard time with this, or in general with opening your heart, he says you can always start with opening your heart to yourself, not opening your heart. When we are generous, we become fully grounded, starting with ourselves in the way things really are. Even if we're not generous, it's good to start with ourselves. To be present with ourselves is the beginning of reality. If you don't remember anything else from this talk today, take that one sentence. To be present with ourselves is the beginning of reality. This doesn't mean, and it's often construed as meaning, that this is a chance to draw a lot of attention to yourself and create a lot of drama around yourself. There's a scene in Emma where picking raspberries is in the offing, and Mr. Knightley offers his gardens as a place to do this, and immediately this very obnoxious new wife of the minister, Mrs. Elton, she immediately says, I'll do everything. I'll make all the invitations. I'll make all the arrangements. And she's in a flurry to do all the things. And of course, Mr. Knightley calmly tells her that he'll, thank you very much, make his own invitations and arrangements. But it's easy to see that she right away wants to make this event all about her and her ego, which has nothing to do with being grounded and starting with herself and the way things really are. The way things really are is that it's Mr. Knightley's estate. It's his home. He has his own protocol. And I think we all know people like this who give gifts thinking about how much they'll be thanked and appreciated rather than whether the gift is even appropriate or needed at all. I mean, sometimes we do feel stingy. And if we feel shame and deal with that by denying our stinginess, then we're being ungenerous toward our own feeling. And this is why I just so love these words of Jane Austen. As I do not choose to have generosity dictated to me, I shall not resolve on giving my cabinet to Anna till the first thought of it has been my own. I think her mother must have been guilt-tripping her into giving this cabinet to Anna. And Jane's comeback taps right into the heart of pure generosity. I want my giving to come from my heart, not from faking being a good person. So we must all try to remember this. We need to take care of our giving just like we take care of anything else, and keeping it pure. No giving just because we think we want to be a good person. But Reb says, furthermore, that every moment is an opportunity to train in generosity. And although every moment is an opportunity, it's also an opportunity to miss the chance. But that's not the end of it, that if, when we miss an opportunity to be generous, there's another opportunity to correct our ungenerous responses, even if we don't notice them till later. Then we can remember our aspiration to be generous and find some other place. For example, if we're not generous with one particular person, we can be generous with our own inability to be generous. This is a process of training. And we may come to feel and act generously toward people in situations we previously could not welcome. But the next day, something else comes up that we don't feel generous about, and we start all over again. But seeing this as a process and a training really helps. You know, we don't take it so personally. If we're working on generosity and we see ourselves missing opportunities, we're thinking in our minds, you know, this is what we're working on right now. And then we miss a chance. First of all, we can work with ourselves, missing the chance. And then we can repair and have other opportunities to be generous. Bodhisattvas vow to learn to meet all beings, including those. Okay, this is the gift of fearlessness now, the second one. Bodhisattvas vow to learn to meet all beings, including those who are different from us, with great compassion. In doing this, it's our responsibility to learn the biases of our social conditioning and welcome our fear and discomfort. This can be really difficult and embarrassing, but it's really called for on the Bodhisattva path. We have to do it. We each have to consider our own best way of facing and changing unconscious habits of self-clinging. The Bodhisattva precepts and paramitas, which are designed to turn our mind towards selflessness, they're designed to turn our mind to others. And those are tools that we can use for support in working on these paramitas. Reb says we can learn to welcome everything, including our failures. And especially if you're a person who rarely fails, you can take a step back and say, you know, who am I when I fail? Who is this person whose poor preparation caused these unfortunate things to happen? And then really take a look. This part of yourself might be starved for attention and love. We normally avoid it. Many of us shun this part of ourselves, but failure holds enormous information. And if we stay close, we can learn a lot. I want to also, in this part about fearlessness, say that a lot of us are afraid to say no and set boundaries. And sometimes no is exactly the right thing to offer another person. And if you're a person for whom saying no is a problem, next time you say yes instead of no, when you want to say no, really look at it. Just stop inside yourself. What are your motives? Why are you, who are you trying to please other than, more than your wish to be authentic? Actually, setting an appropriate boundary is a big yes. It can be a big yes to yourself and the other person and your relationship. When setting an appropriate boundary means saying no, and you can't say it out of fear, don't stop studying the situation until you can say yes with respect instead of no out of fear. And this will mean you're seeing things, yourself and the situation, more clearly. Regarding the gifts of Dharma, bodhisattvas aspire to offer all their actions of body, speech, and mind as Dharma gifts. And this can be as simple as being courteous and thorough in your responses to people. This kind of behavior is available to all of us, and it's really helpful. So no ghosting. Seriously. It's ghosting, as you all know. It's the way. It's the way now. And it means that no one, I'm exaggerating, is practicing. Many people who are doing ghosting are not practicing how to care properly for others and giving the gift of themselves in being thorough and compassionate in a response, in any kind of reason, to make a response to something that comes to you. When someone requests something from you, then you respond as compassionately as you can. And this this new way ignores all of that. And so it doesn't get any practice in that either. And so that's kind of like wiped off the chart of possible behaviors even. And so we get less and less compassionate. That's what I worry about when I see this. Taking care of your body also means giving it and using it for the practice of generosity, rather than caring for your body to keep it from changing. So we care for our body to practice generosity and the other five paramitas, to practice Buddhism, to practice. We don't practice to keep our bodies from changing. So our culture is so mired. I'm sorry, this is my second criticism of our culture, ghosting, and also this attachment to youth and youngness. So we're mired in that, and we end up using our bodies to keep it from changing. And then we notice a change because impermanence is reality. And then we're mortified. And instead, we need to use our body for practicing the Dharma. And it will do that to the best possible now and in the future, and as long as it lives, and then it dies and it can't do the best possible anymore in this lifetime. But there's nothing in there about keeping it from changing. There's no way to keep your body from changing. So we use it to practice the Dharma. And in fact, the fact that it changes and becomes ill, and there are imperfections and limitations, the Buddha used that to teach. So at the end of his life, when he had a pain in his back at one point when he was giving a Dharma talk, he was unable to sit upright. So instead, he reclined on his Dharma seat and he asked his senior disciple, Mahakasyapa, he gave him the robe and he said, please give the talk today. And later, when he was ill, he took a reclining position for his final Dharma talk, which was on, this is how one respects and treats one's body when it grows weak. So he was lying down, reclining, and he gave a talk from that position. And in both cases, he offered the limitations of his body as teaching moments, as Dharma gifts. Taking care of our body translates into giving our body the sleep that we need, the food that nourishes us, the livelihood that supports and nourishes our heart and mind, and the spiritual practice that also does this. When we are generous and kind to our body, mind, and spirit, appropriate forms of practice emerge. And welcoming them means just letting experiences be the way they appear to us. When we're generous with ourselves in this way, it reveals the truth and helps us realize the emptiness of giver, receiver, and gift. Everything seems very fluid. So from here, going out a little bit on a limb right now, I'd like to share with you some passages from a contemporary novel that I'm rereading because it's so good, entitled The Chef, C-H-E-F-F-E, which is a recently minted word in French meaning female cook or female chef. And this book is by Marie, I can't pronounce it, Ndiaye, capital N, capital D, I-A-Y-E, Marie Ndiaye. I'm sure that's not right. And she's half French and half Senegalese. And I think that this book exemplifies all three kinds of generosity: material things, food, fearlessness, as I'll read to you, and the Dharma, as I'll read to you. The narrator is a young man who worked in her kitchen and was very much in love with her when she became very famous. And late at night, he'd stay behind, and the kitchen was all cleaned up, and there was nothing to do, and she, the chef, would reveal a lot about her life to him. And so this is the book, and so then he tells us her story. And so at age 14, the chef's impoverished family sent her to work as a maid for a family called the Clapeaus. And they also had a cook and a gardener. But their very unimaginative cook left when the Clapeaus, who loved eating above everything, they were gluttons, actually, and the book makes this clear. When they traveled to their summer home, their own cook just left, and they didn't know what to do. So they asked the chef who had just turned 16 to take her place. So I'm going to read to you. This first paragraph is really about, you know, well, why couldn't they just cook for themselves? So if, she explained, the Clapeaus, this is, so she being the chef, explained to him, the narrator. So if, she explained, the Clapeaus didn't think they were allowed to cook, it was because no communication can be had with the object of your worship, in this case, food, except by a way of an intermediary, knowingly or unknowingly destined for that role. And that was the cook, who, even with her many failings, did indeed perform all the duties of that very special, undelegable mission. The Clapeaus would have thought they were committing an unpardonable offense against the sacred laws of cooking if they arrogantly set out to enter into contact with it, to lay their hands on it, shall we say. So he's answering the question, well, why didn't they just cook for themselves? And this is her own attitude at the beginning of this opportunity. She would, she thought, have striven not to fulfill their wishes, which were in any case vague, contradictory, unworkable, but to cook with such little regard for the contingencies of their respective situations, with a will so bent on creating a perfection far beyond the chance likes and dislikes of all concerned, both them and her, that the Clapeaus would have to surrender to her happily, gratefully. She would, she thought, have cooked in a way that couldn't be argued with. It was the sincerity of her quest for a culinary ideal that the Clapeaus wouldn't be able to question. They would understand and admire it because they themselves were searching for a gastronomical experience that would raise them above mere gluttony, that would let them forgive themselves for being what they were. They knew, so now this is me talking, they knew they were gluttons and hated themselves for it, but they couldn't help it. So then back to the book. I hope you're understanding. This is a 16-year-old who's never cooked, but is suddenly realizing this passion that she has, that she didn't even know about, to be a chef. And she later becomes extremely famous. So this is like her first glimmer of, oh, not only can I do this, but I can do this fantastically. And she's having this idea of cooking in such a way that no one could even argue with it. For the first time in her life, she felt she was in a place that would be hers and hers alone. There was a newish gas stove and an old wood burning oven, many pots and pans and casseroles of all sizes, and a hodgepodge of out-of-date spices and condiments like jarred ashes, accumulated by the cook who'd taken care not to label or name them, guarding her secrets, the chef immediately thought. Not that she was unhappy with what she was finding, since the cook's past appearances on this stage erased, she wouldn't have to follow in her footsteps. So this was the old cook whose place she was taking on a few hours' notice. Back to the book. She said nothing of all that to the Clapeaus, nothing of what she was thinking, didn't confess her emotion on discerning in that little room severely guarded by an old pine tree planted just outside, the brand new elements of a happiness and a raptness she was now feeling for the first time, though she had a glimpse of it when she lay in her bed at night, mentally drawing up menus, list of perfect dishes, corrections to the one she'd eaten, but only a glimpse or an illusion. And now the reality of that happiness, that raptness, was spreading all through her 16-year-old body, eager, as she said, to finally go to work. The chef would later devote all her care to respecting the products she used. She inwardly bowed down before them, paying them homage, grateful, honoring them as best she could. Vegetables, herbs, plants, animals, she took nothing for granted, wasted nothing, damaged nothing, mistreated nothing, defiled no creation of nature, however modest, and the same went for human beings. Even if her work didn't involve chopping them up, the same went for all of us. She never humiliated us. So those are just passages from this marvelous book. Dogen would definitely have approved. But as you can see, I hope that her fearlessness, like she just upped and did it passionately, her fearlessness and her food prepared with her sacred mind gives us all three kinds of generosity wrapped up in one devotional, self-made ritual. It's very powerful. So all three of them, material things, fearlessness, and Dharma, her sacred mind is the Dharma. So it's a beautiful example of how we do anything if we do it with this mind and pure intentions. We give material things, we give whatever we're doing, and we give our fearless attitude of doing it with pure intentions, which is the Dharma itself. So like the Buddha, we practice generosity because we want to help others learn generosity. Generosity sets us up to be present and still with what is real. Through the practice of giving, we are warming up to letting go of everything in every moment, which is perfect wisdom. If we have not learned to wholeheartedly give and receive for the welfare of others, we will not be able to be entirely at peace and ease with ourselves. So here's are what I think at least some of the most important points. There are eight. First, my favorite, Jane Austen's, as I do not choose to have generosity dictated to me, I shall not resolve on giving my cabinet to Anna till the first thought of it has been my own. Don't give just to be able to think of yourself as a good person. Give because you feel it. You want to give something to someone else. Second, to be present with ourselves is the beginning of reality. Third, if you have a hard time giving and opening your heart, Reb says, you can always start with opening your heart to yourself not opening your heart. Fourth, when we are generous with our body, we see that it depends on everything that is not our body. Fifth, taking care of our body means giving and using it for the practice of generosity, rather than taking care of our body to keep it from changing. Sixth, taking care of our body translates as giving ourselves the sleep that we need, 8 hours, the food that nourishes us, the livelihood that supports and nourishes our heart and mind, and the spiritual practice that also does this. When we are generous and kind to our body, mind, and spirit, appropriate forms of practice emerge. And seventh, it is our responsibility to learn about the biases of our social conditioning and welcome fear and discomfort. This can be deeply difficult and embarrassing work, but it is really called for on the Bodhisattva path. And eighth, we practice generosity because we want to help others learn to practice it. And here are some five things for you to reflect on during the week. And the first one, again, this sentence that I adore, as I do not choose to have generosity dictated me, to me, I shall not resolve on giving my cabinet to Anna till the first thought of it has been my own. What are your thoughts about these strong words of Jane Austen? And give an example of when you did not practice this and what it felt like in your body and mind and spirit. So when you, I'm asking you to give an, first of all, what do you think about that? And second of all, give an example of when you didn't do it. When you gave something when you didn't really want to, but you did it because you thought you wanted to be a good person, but you needed to do it for some reason. And what did that feel like? Just what did that feel like for you to describe that? Okay, and then the second one, we can correct our ungenerous responses when we notice them later. We can remember our aspiration to be generous and find some other place where we do feel generous. For example, if we're not generous with a particular person, perhaps we can be generous with our own inability to be generous. So that was a teaching. And the thing I'm suggesting you reflect on is to describe an occasion where you missed an opportunity to be generous and what happened from there. Did you realize you missed the opportunity? Did you feel regretful? Did you feel helpless at first to make an effort towards repair? If you did make an effort, was it helpful in deepening your self-relationship? So just to study this, you know, what happened if you missed an opportunity to be generous and on some level you caught it? And then what happened from there? So I'm asking you basically in all of this, I'm asking you to really study your relationship with generosity in general. Just when you're generous, when you're not generous, how you're generous, and the repercussions of all of that. Third, taking care of our body means giving and using it for, okay, this is really controversial now. Taking care of our body means giving and using it for spiritual practice rather than taking care of our body to keeping it from changing. And this is similar to the stricture that we eat to follow our way, not for pleasure. So in Buddhism, there is that stricture. We eat to follow our way, not for pleasure. That was the whole basis of begging in Buddhist time. You know, in Buddhist time, everyone, there was a rule in the monastery where you ate before noon and everyone took their bowl. Everyone had a bowl, and you take your bowl out to a random street, and then you go up to each house and hold your bowl. And it was known. And it gave, so it was both to receive food, but it was almost even more importantly to give the people a chance to make an offering to monks, which was very good karma for them. It was a very good, it was giving them a chance to do something that would be very good for them, very beneficial for them. And so you receive this food, and then you, and then all of them together went back to the monastery and ate it together, ate their whatever was in their bowl before noon. So this is, that's all the food they had all day. So that was their food. So we eat to practice our way, not for pleasure. So whatever was in their bowl, period. That was all, end of story. This is very controversial, and I'm asking you in this question to, what do you think about this very difficult and outdated practice? That's all, that's the question. What do you think about it? Both of those things, practicing for the Dharma, basically, as opposed to keeping our bodies from changing, using our body to practice the Dharma. And eating to practice our way as opposed to for pleasure. Okay, fourth, Suzuki Roshi told Reb, I think I didn't mention this in our talk, but Suzuki Roshi told Reb, this is about boundaries, that it's all right to be informal with acquaintances, but for intimate relationships, we need some formality. This is in the part about boundaries. Do you agree with that? That in your intimate relationships, you need to have more boundaries than in your casual relationships? And what kind of formality do you have in your intimate relationships? And what would you say it accomplishes? So this question is about boundaries in your intimate relationships. What kind do you have, and how do they serve you, if any? Okay, and then the last question is, on a scale of 1 to 10, and not forgetting that generosity is a state of mind, we talked about that last time, this is a state of mind, where do you think you fall in the realm of generosity? In what's, which means, in what parts of this practice do you excel, or in what parts do you not do so well, and in what parts do you fail altogether? And could you pick one thing to work on to change for the better? So just, I'm asking you to look at your whole practice of generosity, which is your state of mind. Do you never think about generosity? Which is okay. I mean, we're just starting. So it's okay to never think about it. But now you can notice, you know, what is your relationship with this first paramita, generosity? It's called dana in Sanskrit, and it's considered the basis of all the other paramitas. It's where everything starts, this generous mind. I wonder if you have questions.
Yes, Gail. The first that we have is, I do not believe I've heard the word authentic used so often within our meetings. Why is it so large a part of this topic rather than others? Or is it assumed, or have I missed this in another session?
Well, authenticity and the paramitas are the same thing. When we are coming from our authentic self, we are generous. We are ethical, because ethicalness is simply thinking carefully about the effect of your behavior on other people. We are patient. Patience just arises in us because of our care for others. We are joyful in our efforts because they just are spontaneous. And on the basis of that, we are concentrated and we are wise. This is our real core being, unadorned. We don't always, we have a lot of layers on us because of what's required in our culture and in our society. But what we're learning here is about who we actually are. And who we actually are, I mean, it's really a little shocking that it's surprising to hear that we are in our core being, unadorned. We are generous, we are ethical, we are patient, we are joyful, we are concentrated, and we do have wisdom. That's our real self. And that's why staying with yourself, staying grounded in yourself, is the basis of reality. And staying grounded in yourself, you will see all six of these. I don't even like to use the word quality. I don't know what word is the best. Practice? I'm not sure. These ways of being in the world, they are who we are. So that's my answer. We're talking about being who we are. And we're using these paramitas to show us who we are. And that's authenticity itself. Thank you. That was a really good question.
Thank you, Gail. The next one we have is, Bodhas are those who have wholeheartedly encountered and authenticated ordinariness. I wonder why it takes such a long time and such extraordinary effort to become ordinary.
I know. It seems ridiculous. But the reason it takes a long time is that it's all about moving things away as opposed to taking things on. So we take away and we take away and we take away. This is just an example, but an example of when we're getting closer to to being real is after like a 7-day sesshin or a 5-day sesshin, and you've done nothing but zazen all day long, first 5 or 7 days. And there's a kind of lucidity and freedom that happens after that. You just don't feel like making a pretense about anything. And so you're just like you. And then you're just ordinary you. There's no anything else. But you've just done zazen for 7 days. And then you're just like, there's no energy for making a pretense for anything. So that's all that work to just get back to who we are. And the closer we get to nothing, the closer we get to who we are. Because actually, nothing is how it is. Ultimate truth-wise, nothing is how it is. We just sit in the zendo becoming nothing, and that's how it is. That's Zen practice. That's Zen practice in a nutshell. And maybe you're not interested, but what I know is that it's a little bit of a trap once you start. Really, once you start even sitting zazen, and you see how hard it is, and you think, oh, I don't want any part of this, but it's already too late. I think it's really I'm sorry about that, but it happened to me, obviously, too. Anyway, that's my answer. It just takes a long time getting rid of a lot of stuff in order to be just nothing, ordinary us. Thank you.
So someone else shared that I am stuck on the idea of not attaching to our feelings and thoughts. I am pretty moody, whichever way my mood swings, it colors everything. I almost can't imagine a life without moods, frankly.
I think you're going to have to start with detaching yourself from identifying with your mood. So anger is there, but I am not my anger. I am not my anger. So where is the part of me that's not angry? You might remember from before, where is the part? A monk was busy sweeping the monastery grounds and asking himself, where is the part of me that's not busy? And then here, where is the part of me that's not angry? And so it's about holding space for yourself to exist separately from what your brain manufactures. Then you continue with your life and you let your moods just sit there. And after a while, it changes into something else. And you notice that and you keep following the development of this transformational process. And of both yourself and your mood separately. And at a certain point, you'll feel ready to decide on an action to take on behalf of your anger, but it won't be the same action that you would have taken if you hadn't have done this process. So that's my answer, and go ahead and try it. It's about detaching yourself. You can realize what you're thinking and you cannot be attached to what you're thinking. And then you can also try to find the place inside you that isn't moody. Where is the place inside you that isn't moody? There is a place like that. And with Zen practice, you'll grow to feature that. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So somebody else asked that to be present with ourselves is the beginning of reality. This idea makes me afraid because I don't think I'm present with myself very often. Does this mean I just live in a dream world? It doesn't feel like that. My stories all feel very real to me.
Yes. No, you're not living in a dream world, but yes, I understand. Your stories are very real and very normal, and they're painful and it hurts both. And so you stay close to your stories and close to your pain, and you just keep listening and staying close and empathic to yourself and your stories, your pain and your stories. You stay empathic and open and close, and you just sit there in it. You just sit there in your pain and your compassion. And that is exactly where the Buddhas and our ancestors live. So that is Buddhist practice right there. That is Buddhist practice. I'm glad you asked the question, and it's hard to make this answer, but this answer is the truth. And now it's time to stop. And I want to thank my team, Sahar and Brian and Brendan. And I want to thank you for attending and those of you who listen during the week and at other times to these talks. I so appreciate it. And without you, they wouldn't be happening. And next week, we'll talk about the second paramita, ethical behavior. Thank you. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.